Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Today, a look at local and regional foods in an entirely new way. My guest today has written one of the most interesting and novel books about local food I've ever read, combining food writing with a literary sensibility and essays that meander as far and wide as his food choices, combining history, sociology, and science. At first glance, The Mad Feast, an ecstatic tour through America's food, looks a lot like books celebrating American culinary diversity, with 50 essays, one for each state, with a food with each state. Cheesesteak in Pennsylvania, brisket in Texas, or the Sheboygan bratwurst in Wisconsin. But in reading an essay on, say, deep dish pizza for Illinois, titled The Biblical Rheology of Deep Dish Pizza, you'll find writing that touches on the endless Chicago winter, geology, relating it to the deep dish pizza, and the writings of Carl Sandburg. Now, the man behind The Mad Feast is Matthew Gavin Frank, who has worked in the food industry on and off for over 20 years, and in his previous books has written on everything from Italian winemaking to the social hierarchies of a medical marijuana farm in California. He teaches creative writing in Michigan, home of the pasty, and joins us today here on Studio Tulsa, home of the Oaky Sirloin, as our guest. Matthew Gavin Frank, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
It's a pleasure to be here, Rich. Thank you for having me.
You have to tell me about the inspiration for The Mad Feast, because when you look at the book, it looks like the sort of book you'd expect to see either on the travel or the intersection between travel and food shelves, because it looks like it's just going to be a straightforward description of 50 regional dishes, one from each state. But once you get into this book, you find it is a completely different animal. It is a literary adventure which uses food as a starting point.
Yeah, I mean, food was definitely a springboard, I suppose, albeit a delicious one, into a lot of the strange and shadowy back alleys of U.S. regional history. And basically, I wanted to see what would happen if the foodstuffs, typical of each of the 50 U.S. states, were held up against the backdrop of some of these strange histories and embedded within kind of that rich context, to see how that historical context would perhaps comment on the foodstuff itself and how the foodstuff would converse with the context, all basically toward the end of making some sort of statement, however hazy, as to why we eat, what we eat, where we eat it, and what that can tell us about ourselves as far as the ways in which we identify regionally, and then if we conflate that, the ways in which we identify as a nation.
Well, what's really interesting to me is when you get into this book, you know, you always hear talk of how our culture is homogenizing, that regional differences, regional accents are smoothing out, if you will, the look of the landscape. You know, you can be driving nearly every state in a certain part of a city, it looks exactly like every other city, that sort of homogenization. But what's really apparent is our food variations still really exist, because there's some really interesting and very different food that you discuss in this book.
Sure. I think the homogenization of American culture is certainly an appropriate surface narrative, but I felt as if it was my duty in this book, of course, via the lens of food, to scratch and scratch and scratch at that surface narrative to see what kind of strange and twitchy inner holiness or horror began to leak out from beneath the surface. And all sorts of, very staunch and fierce and unique regional cuisines and stories still thrive in our very rich and complicated country.
Now, in the very first state you take on is Florida, and you use as the gateway into Florida the ubiquitous key lime pie. Right. But you tell us a lot about key lime pies that probably most people don't even really think about, why the key lime pie was originally created. And you also introduce us to this character, or a composite, if you will, that keeps returning throughout the book. He's known as Uncle, and an uncle, he's kind of a very interesting uncle. he's laying down. He's moribund, like a moribund from the climate and the heat and the humidity.
Right. He's a curmudgeon. the uncle. Yeah. Began with Florida. I actually lived for about 3.5 years in Key West, Florida, working in restaurant kitchens there and making a lot of key lime pie. And I spent most of my occupational life in restaurant kitchens, actually. I started when I was 11 years old washing dishes in a fast food chicken shack on the outskirts of Chicago, and then just kind of stayed in it on and off for the next 20 years. So eventually that led me to Key West. And after dealing with so much key lime pie there and taking it for granted, I began to wonder what its story was, and then in turn what Florida's story was, why the state of Florida basically was the perfect incubator for this particular dish that we now take for granted when we're down there, especially in the Keys. But after working down there for quite a while, I wrote these chapters and these essays in an attempt to answer those questions.
You know, and this is one of the interesting things. There's a little aside that this uncle character, which keeps showing up and is sort of undersided guide to the food and the history of the state. And in Uncle's case, you know, he's living down in the Keys, and he's kind of resentful that this creation of the Keys, which for such a long time was the only place you could get it, was in South Florida. And now it's like everywhere, you know, there's Jell-O with key lime pie, and
which is blasphemy, clearly. But the uncle character who recurs throughout the book, he is a composite character. He is one part my uncle and probably nine parts other people's uncles. He basically exhibits the characteristics of many different folks who I interviewed for the sake of this book, too, kind of boiled down into this bouillon cube of a curmudgeon. He also serves as a wonderful foil to me, or me as persona, throughout the book. And we are able to argue in that way and push, and he interrogates some of the statements that I am making in the book, and vice versa. And it becomes more of a complex conversation in that way, which basically attests to the very true fact that there are so many different regional narratives behind each of these foodstuffs that I'm engaging, each of them kind of staking their claim of authenticity. But oftentimes they're very different and very conflicting, and rather than trying to sweep all of these conflicting narratives under the table and falsely point towards something singular, I basically, via the character of the uncle, inflamed those conflicting narratives because they're more true than the singularity. We are a country rife with conflicting narratives.
Now, the one thing I learned about key lime pie, which I never knew this, was that the reason it came into existence was because it originally didn't have to be refrigerated.
Right, yeah.
Or cooked, for that matter.
That's right. The key limes, in conjunction with the eggs and the condensed milk, basically the key limes would cook it, and it was a process called souring, where the key limes would preserve the ingredients that would otherwise spoil. There are food historians who believe that it was invented by sponge fishermen in the Florida Keys in the late 1800s. And because the sponge fishermen were bound to their boats for days on end, they needed to pack foods that refused to spoil, even in the heat of the Florida Keys, along with an easy protein source and fruit that they culled from the local trees. And so cans of condensed milk, eggs, and key limes made their ways onto the boat.
Now, as you go through the 50 states, you find some foods that are ones you would normally associate with a state, like brisket for Texas, or chili for Ohio, Cincinnati chili for that matter. But there are also some ones I had never heard of, and probably a number of residents in the state probably hadn't heard of. And in fact, even in Oklahoma, you use a name I never heard of for this particular food, which is, I have to admit, an Oklahoma food, and that's Okie sirloin, which is barbecue bologna.
Yeah, that's right. According to my research, I actually spoke to, and this goes for each of the states, but when I was researching the Oklahoma essay, I conducted a lot of interviews with Oklahoma chefs, barbecue chefs, folks working at historical societies and museums, and so on. And I also, of course, consulted the Encyclopedia of Oklahoma History and Culture. And the barbecue bologna is oftentimes pejoratively known, especially within Oklahoma, I mean, even more so than outside of Oklahoma, as the Okie sirloin, which is a derogatory term, frankly. But a lot of folks don't consider it. I mean, it has very derogatory origins, but a lot of folks don't consider it to be terribly derogatory these days, given the fact that even Jane and Michael Stern, of road food fame, in their book, The Lexicon of Real American Food, refer to barbecue bologna as the Okie sirloin, and they think that's okay.
Well, I know people of a certain age would never like anything with the term Okie on it. That was a pejorative term. But I have to admit, there is nothing like good smoked barbecue bologna. It is right up there with the onion burger as our way of sort of going further with less. And making good food out of it in the meantime. And there is that sort of undercurrent in a lot of the book. St. Louis barbecue is one thing, but the milk can dinner up in the Midwest.
Wyoming, yeah.
Yeah, foods that were sort of very regional, but at the same time on the hierarchy of food on the lower side, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but, I did gravitate toward very humble regional cuisine. A lot of dishes that were birthed in desperation, frankly. And some of those dishes evolved into pretty high-end dishes these days, but they have very, very humble origins. It's the lobster story. Lobster, of course, is now a luxury item, but it began as a food for the poor. It was seen as the giant cockroach of the sea and was actually prison food. Lobster originally, and I don't write about this in the book, but lobster was originally fed to prisoners, and now it has evolved. And I was just interested in how these stories that are leashed to the very same food tend to shift as history shifts. One of the other ones that you didn't mention is it's in the Minnesota essay, and the dish in Minnesota is hot dish. Which essentially is a catch-all casserole birthed in desperation. It began in Lutheran church basements where folks who were suffering economically would gather and basically pour all of these kind of hearty, high-fat, stick-to-your-ribs ingredients into one particular dish in order to feed a lot of people high-calorie food, in order to feed the masses. It's the same thing with barbecue bologna, which I agree with you. It is absolutely fantastic. I love it. I actually have visited all 50 states in my research for this book and have eaten all of these dishes, and the barbecue bologna was indelible.
My guest today is Matthew Gavin Frank. His latest book is titled The Mad Feast, an ecstatic tour through America's food. It's published by Live Right, and in which he writes these wonderful essays, which gets into all sorts of history, like the chapter on the Minnesota tater tot casserole, if you will. That's how I know that particular dish. But, you know, you get into the whole desperation of the times. People were starving during a time of want. And you get into all sorts of history, like when you're talking about Purlieu in South Carolina, you're riffing on race and really serious issues as a part of this discussion of food. Now, Purlieu is sort of like a pilaf in a way, but what is Purlieu exactly?
Purlieu is essentially, it is like a pilaf or like a pilau. In India, it's known as a biryani, except, of course, it's differently spiced. It's sort of like the South Carolinians would hate that I'm describing it this way, but it is kind of like a differently spiced, low-country jambalaya.
Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah, that's right. You got a duck, you got some smoked sausage, some rice and celery, what do they refer to that as, the Holy Trinity?
Onion,
celery, and...
What is that, bell pepper, onion, and celery?
Yeah, yeah. Right.
very similar to a paella, a risotto, rice dish, rife with spice, and oftentimes in good times, meat and seafood.
You have some pretty unusual foods in this. What would you say was the most unusual to you as you decided to write about it?
The rat stew ate and then highlighted part of the West Virginia chapter was certainly unusual. I found out a bunch of really interesting things about our long history of eating rats, though. Of course, in West Virginia, folks were forced to empty their rat traps oftentimes directly into a stock pot due to the collapse of the mining industry, both actual physical collapses, wherein a lot of the wage-earning patriarchs perished, and then the economic collapse of the industry. So rat stew for a while thrived in West Virginia and still thrives in certain portions of the state. As a matter of fact, the town of Marlinton, West Virginia, celebrates the eating of rat and roadkill as part of their cultural inheritance through a annual roadkill cook-off, which I did attend, and at which I ate some rat stew. The rat meat could be described, I guess, as a sour pork, but not sour in a bad way, Rich. Sour as if marinated in citrus, as if marinated in, you know, orange and lemon and lime juice. And so it was actually very pleasant. And then as I continued to conduct my research, I found that rats were once seen as the foodstuff of the French aristocracy. In old Bordeaux in France, the vintners would often trap rats and then prepare them with a lovely sauce of red wine and shallot and tarragon, and then roast the rat meat, actually, over the broken-down Bordeaux wine barrels, which would impart into the rat meat flavors of oak and Cabernet Sauvignon and Merlot and Petit Verdot and all of this. And it was seen as high-end food, but we removed the rat from Bordeaux, and we situated in West Virginia as an edible, and all of a sudden its story changes.
I love the fact that you actually, in that essay, you quote the West Virginia state code statute, which allows roadkill to be taken home and eaten.
Yeah, that's true. And it is eaten happily, I found. At the annual roadkill cook-off in Marlinton, some of the names folks come up with for their dishes were just incredibly goofy and fun-loving. I remember there was this guy who was preparing a teriyaki rat shish kebab, and what did he call it? Rat-a-tat teriyaki or something. So folks definitely celebrated the eating of roadkill, at the very least in Marlinton.
And in your recipe, in the end of each chapter, you have a recipe, and there you let us know that it could be rat stew or it could be squirrel stew.
Yeah, absolutely. In a pinch, squirrel will substitute nicely, I was told.
I really found the chapter on Pennsylvania interesting. First of all, you get into the whole cheesesteak controversy between Geno's and Pat's, but also there's this long riff on Jerry Sandusky and Joe Paterno, and what did he know and did he know, and why tell that story as a part of this story on Pennsylvania?
Essentially, it was part of establishing regional context, and as I was mentioning, I was engaging a lot of shadowy back alleys of regional history, And when I came to the Pennsylvania essay, and this stands for a few of the essays too, the Ohio essay and things, I felt as if some of these shadowy back alleys of regional history existed somewhat recently. And so I mean, not only did I decide to create the context, in which the Philly cheesesteak thrives by talking about, the Civil War and Jefferson Davis and so on, but I felt as if contemporary history, when held up against that dish, could have a conversation with the cheesesteak, too. It was all about embedding the dish within that larger sociocultural and regional context, however harrowing, however horrific.
Yeah, no, and you, even when you're talking about the two cheesesteak changes, you sort of get into the whole thing about immigration, and here are these heavily immigrant neighborhoods, and one of the cheesesteak locations says you have to order in English. It's sort of this, well, irony in a way.
it's amazing how if you scratch the Philly cheesesteak, I mean, there is a lot of beauty attached to it, of course, but there is a lot of ugliness attached to it, too. I mean, in my research, I was invariably led to strange regional histories that kind of supported racism and xenophobia and other sorts of atrocious things. So, it's strange how these sorts of stories in my research kept attaching themselves to what is otherwise just a really delicious sandwich. But we can't take it for granted anymore.
Now, one of the most interesting essays in the whole collection is Our Neighboring State of Arkansas. And this is a dish I have never heard of, and probably a lot of Arkansans have not heard it either. And it's a, what is it called, beaver tail bouillon?
Yeah, beaver tail bouillon, or I mean, essentially a beaver tail stew. It's a portion of the beaver that, of course, needs a lot of wet heat and a long, low, slow poach, I guess, in order to make it tender. And of course, I was interested in the implications of that metaphorically and things. But
yeah, and the essay is from the point of view of the beaver.
This is true. Yeah, this is one of the more experimental essays in the book. Not only is it from the point of view of a beaver, but it's from the point of view of an ever reincarnating beaver, which again serves as a device to take us through, you know, Arkansas's history from Lewis and Clark up through the Clinton age. And the beaver essentially bears witness to all of these sorts of strange aspects of regional history, let's say from Lewis and Clark to Bill and Hillary. And it must be said that the beaver tail is actually, in many circles, considered a luxury item. It's not cheap, and it's seen as quite the delicacy in certain circles in Arkansas.
Now, where do you find a place that does make a beaver tail stew?
There are still restaurants that do it on Sundays for Sunday lunch. If I remember correctly, there was a town called Fountain Hill that I believe served it. I visited a restaurant called Cotton's that did a beaver tail stew special, I believe, on Friday, in lieu of, say, a fish fry. And then a lot of folks just did it. They trapped, of course, on their own and prepared beaver tail as this celebratory dish if somebody, you know, had a graduation or something like that.
Mm. Of the 50 foods that you tasted around the country, was there one that made the greatest impression on you as far as new foods, as far as a food that just instantly became a favorite, if you will?
This is so tough for me to choose, Rich, because actually I like everything. There's not a single foodstuff I don't like. I remember years ago I was struggling with cucumber and melon for some reason, and I didn't enjoy those foods, and I actually forced myself to eat them until I liked them, of course, experimenting with manipulating temperature and texture and flavor combinations until I found my point of entry. I think the way I got into cucumber was I made, this is when I was working in fine dining restaurant kitchens, a cucumber granita to put atop a raw oyster with a little twist of black pepper, and I enjoyed it that way. And all of a sudden, that gave me a point of entry into cucumber as a whole, and so I really like that now. But some of my favorite foods, I have to say the barbecue bologna was amazing. There's this really delicious potato dish that kind of thrives in Utah. They're known as funeral potatoes.
Yeah, I saw that. That was very strange. It was, the name is sort of strange, but it's sort of the, it's like your covered dish, right?
That's it. And, you know, this was a typical dish that offered comfort at funerals, at these potluck kind of mourning sessions. You know, a lot of folks would bring these funeral potatoes, and they're very humble, but very, very delicious. I love the Moravian spice cookie in North Carolina. It's this incredibly thin cookie. They're very, very difficult to make because the cookies are so incredibly thin. It's essentially like the Listerine strip of cookies. You put it on your tongue and it sort of melts. It's kind of amazing. And I really appreciated that cookie because texture-wise, it was so delicate, but flavor-wise, it was so intense. It's filled with all of the spices that you usually heap into, say, pumpkin pie, allspice and clove and nutmeg and the like. And so I really enjoyed the jockeying between this incredibly delicate texture and this somewhat heavy-handed spice flavor. It was complex and delicious. So those are a few of my favorites.
Now, you mentioned beaver tail stew, for example, is a something you're going to find in some of the small towns. It's a sort of the Friday special in certain little restaurants in Arkansas. Are any of these 50 foods sort of on the way towards disappearing, or are the cultures surrounding them all very strong?
You know, a lot of them are really thriving only in just kind of small regional corners, I guess. And sadly, I do think some of these are going away, and the process, at least, of making some of these ingredients, or the processes that attend the making of these ingredients are disappearing, too. It's amazing how there are folks who are trying to save these foods. You know, there is a Save the Endangered Food movement, of course, that is both leashed to the slow food movement that I know a lot of people have heard about, but also just kind of independent writers and food historians are producing these manifestos attempting to save endangered foods. Beaver tail is sadly going away, as is rat stew, you know, as are some of these other dishes about which I write. So some of them are very, very common, and some of them are somewhat secret and are perhaps on their way to extinction.
Well, it's an interesting look at our 50 states of food culture, and I always thought, you know, the Boston cream pie was just a name, and that was actually in Massachusetts. I learned all sorts of things in the book, The Mad Feast, an ecstatic tour through America's food. Matthew Frank, thanks very much for joining us.
Rich, it was a pleasure talking with you. Thank you for having me.
Matthew Gavin Frank is the author of The Mad Feast, an ecstatic tour through America's food. It's published by Live Right. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.